Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, the news is a lot these days. Some people say it's affecting their mental health with a steady stream of 24-hour-a-day TV and radio updates, not to mention what comes through your phone. You want to stay in the know, but how can you pull back at least a little? We have some tips from experts. It's not uncommon for teachers to have to step into a grade level or field they're not licensed to teach. But we have a report on one Illinois school district that saw that happen in more than one-third of classrooms. How did it get to that point? Western Illinois University laid off faculty librarians, but they've now received an honor for working to raise the profile of the job. What are some communities doing to protect their trees from mass die-offs due to pests and disease? And we'll talk soap operas. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The nine faculty librarians at Western Illinois University officially lost their jobs in mid-May. They received layoff notices a year ago as the university administration looked for ways to close a multi-million dollar budget gap. Since then, the nine worked to raise the profile of faculty librarians, and their efforts did not go unnoticed. Rich Egger reports.
The nine are collectively winners of the Illinois Library Association Illinois Academic Librarian of the Year Award. The award is presented by the Illinois Association of College and Research Libraries, which is a division of the ILA.
This is a very prestigious award.
Hunter Dunlap is one of those being honored.
I'm a past president of IICRL, so really appreciate the quality of this award and what it means to a librarian to receive it in the state of Illinois.
Dunlap hopes the recognition will remind people about the importance of academic librarians and what they mean on a university campus. The award will be presented during the 2025 ILA Annual Conference in October in Rosemont. All of the laid-off librarians have been invited to attend, and several have already made plans to do so, including Krista Bowers-Sharp.
It's going to be very affirming, you know, to be receiving an award in front of people that I've worked side-by-side with,
right,
on various joint efforts towards librarianship.
Bowers-Sharp says she believes administrators and even fellow faculty members don't understand what library faculty do. So, during the past year, she created a series of short YouTube videos called Library Magic to explain their role in the institution.
I think over the course of 13 or 14 videos during the year, we addressed various aspects of why is somebody paying for an academic librarian, and I think we made a pretty strong case.
The faculty librarians also created a website where Dunlap says more than 10,000 people filled out a petition urging the administration to reconsider its decision.
I just want to go on record thanking everyone for their support, their help, all the emails and texts and things we've received over the year, which really gave us a lot of encouragement.
Dunlap also served on the Coalition for Higher Education Libraries, which successfully lobbied for creation of the University Library and Professional Librarian Access and Transparency Task Force. Bowers-Sharp says she's proud of how the librarians came together throughout the past year, gathering once a week to make sure they were all on the same page.
It was a real lifeline for all the things that we had to experience during the year to have that group. It was a wonderful group to go through this experience with, very supportive.
Several of the librarians have retired. Some have moved on to new jobs. And some of the librarians are still involved in a legal case against the university over the loss of their jobs. That case is currently in arbitration. Bowers-Sharp and Dunlap both say they became librarians because it's a position where you need to know about a lot of different topics, and you're always learning something new. Now, with a new school year approaching, they find themselves in the unfamiliar position of not having to prepare to help students and faculty. Bowers-Sharp says it's a strange feeling.
I'm definitely missing that feeling of, oh, I need to start thinking about what classes will I be asked to teach a session for? What students will have my name on their syllabus that they need to meet with me to begin their research process?
However, she will be on campus this fall because she's taking a course at Western in anthropology. Bauer Sharp says, just like when she worked at the library, she wants to continue learning. Rich Egger reporting.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that jobs for barbers, hairstylists, and cosmetologists will increase by 7% over the next several years. A Northern Illinois Barber Academy partners with high schools and will soon offer scholarships to make this type of training more accessible. Here's Yvonne Booz with more.
Mark McLaughlin sits in the waiting area of Future Phase Academy in DeKalb. He is one of the regulars. The school recently moved from Sycamore to DeKalb, and McLaughlin followed.
I don't like a lot of people touching my hair, so when I have a cut, I want it done right, and Dre does it right every time, including when I get a shave, as well as I've seen him with his students, and he teaches them the right way to do things.
Dre is Andre Powell, the owner of the school. He says barbering does not have to be an alternative to college. Students can learn a trade and go to college. They don't have to pick.
I just felt like you teach them young, you give them away. I mean, when I came in cutting hair, we were charged, I think, $16 for haircuts. And right now, they're at $50 a haircut. So these kids are fresh out of high school and making $50 in 40 minutes. You can't beat that.
Powell started cutting hair in 2016. In 2020, he and a friend decided to teach the skill because he says there was a shortage of barbers. So they decided to create some. Devin Brown is a student there. He's on track to finish in November. Today, he's cutting the hair of a teenager with a few tips from Powell. Brown says he's working on his efficiency.
It takes me a little longer to do, like, you know, haircuts, and it can be a little overwhelming at times, especially when, you know, you don't know everything, like what to do and stuff like that sometimes. So.
Regular barbers may charge up to $50 for a basic cut. The school only charges $15. But it takes longer since students are still learning. Anayeli Victoria just started. She has two sons and says learning to cut hair will save her money. She also has another motivator.
Since it's mostly males, like I feel like I would make more money from that. Because I used to also be a server at Rancheros. So I would be like, oh, you know, maybe the tips would be good and the payments are good. So every man needs a haircut.
Jalen Garbutt is just observing this day. He wants to get his license, but says he doesn't have the money for school.
I like to see people cutting hair, so also like get some guidance, some information on things I want to do. Also, I inspire myself to be a barber someday. It's like a good skill to have.
There's help for those who can't afford tuition. The school offers payment plans and will soon have scholarships. And Powell says there are other options.
There's like the WIOLA program where, you know, they're all about workforce development and workforce training. And if you're low income and you qualify, you know, you can get connected with them for employment training. And we are an approved vendor on their list.
The Federal Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act gives individuals access to jobs, education, and training. The Academy also offers opportunities for high school students through the Kishwaukee Education Consortium. It's a 2-year barber training course for high school juniors and 1-year program for seniors. Those who take courses during school hours will receive high school credit. McLaughlin, Powell's regular customer, hasn't had one of the students cut his hair yet, but he says he's willing to if Powell asks.
Everybody needs their hair cut, so it's a great thing to pass on. And as many students as he has here and the skill set he's given them and helping them to build, it's an amazing thing for youth and for adults.
Illinois requires barbers to have 1,500 hours to become licensed. The school also offers an instructor, refresher, and cross-training courses. The academy currently has 10 students, but can't accommodate up to 25. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Next up, NPR's Scott Simon talks with Natalie Moore about the legacy of soap operas. She's the host and writer of Stories Without End, a new season of the WBEZ podcast, Making.
It's time now for some stories. Like sands through the hourglass, so are the days of our lives.
Mickey Horton has lost his memory. Will he ever find his way home? Bo Brady's father isn't Mr. Brady. He's not even Irish. Will Hope still love him? The evil Stefano D'Amara is dead. Wait, no! He's alive! No, no, he's dead! Wait, wait, wrong! The Phoenix has risen again. Soap operas have kept viewers riveted for generations.
Channel 7, and my favorite was All My Children.
Can you do the theme?
That sounds so bad.
This is Natalie Moore, host and writer of the latest season of the WBEZ podcast, Making. It's called Stories Without End, and it's all about the soaps. Soap operas. Natalie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, and like so many other great achievements of civilization, skyscrapers splitting the atom and mustard only on hot dogs. What we call soap operas got their start in Chicago, didn't they?
They started on radio in 1930 on WGN, and some executives asked a woman named Erna Phillips if she would write a daily scripted series, and it was called Painted Dreams.
Daughter of Maida White Roberts held on suspicion of murder. I don't say why.
And then there is one soap that made the transition from radio to television, and that is The Guiding Light in 1952, and then it went off the air on CBS in 2009.
Nowadays, of course, series are maybe, you know, 8 episodes. There's a finite limit on it, and they take off the summer. That was not true with the soaps, was it?
No, it wasn't. There are no reruns in soaps, and I think just because they started as serials, they just kept going.
I mean, arguably, as much as figures like Jack Benny or Edward R. Murrow, they created network television.
They did. And soaps have been looked down upon as this lowbrow form of entertainment. And that's part of the reason they really haven't gotten their due. And I'm also making the argument that soaps have been much more ahead of its time on social issues than primetime. They got to do subversive storylines around abortion, around queer representation, around HIV and AIDS.
Tell us about that. Let's take it one by one. Abortion, for example.
This is my favorite one to talk about because so many people look to Maude, the Norman Lear show, as being the first abortion on television in the 1970s. And there was an abortion on Another World in 1964. Also, Erica Kane had an abortion on All My Children in 1971. She was married and she was a model. And she said, I don't want to be a mother. Agnes Nixon, who's also a soap legend and a protege of Erna Phillips, wrote that a lot of people were not happy in the pro-choice movement about Erica Kane as someone who had an abortion because she was a vixen. She didn't fit this ideal of a downtrodden woman who didn't have enough options.
Have you always loved me, Mom? Have you? How could you even ask me a question like that?
Let me ask you about a character in All My Children, Erica's daughter, Bianca Montgomery.
Do you love me now? Bianca? Do you? Yes. I'm gay.
This was a line in the days when if somebody said I'm gay, it was uttered below their breath, wasn't it?
Yes, and what is really significant here is that Erica Kane's daughter, Bianca, was a member of the core family. The audience had seen Bianca be born on screen in 1988. You know, there's this really strong intergenerational quality of soaps. We grow to care about these characters. And the actress who played Bianca talked about a friend of hers coming out to his grandmother. And the grandmother, he was worried. The grandmother said, oh, like Bianca, that's great.
Tell us about what I'll refer to as the storytelling arc that some of the soaps went through portraying Black characters.
Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee were on The Guiding Light. And Erna Phillips said that she wanted to have storylines about segregation, but the network wouldn't go for it. Agnes Nixon decided to introduce a race storyline as one of the inaugural storylines on One Life to Live in 1968. Black characters have been on soaps for a long time. But there's also been this feeling that they have been sidekicks and not always front and center. Young and the Restless had really popular characters in the 90s that were front and center. And now we have not only a new soap opera on CBS, but it is about a Black core family beyond the gates.
A gated community in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., right?
Yes, I'm guessing that is Potomac, Maryland.
Let me ask about some of the couples who have appeared on soaps before us: Luke and Laura, Angie and Jess, Victor and Nikki, Eden and Cruz, Marlena and Roman. But also, I mean, Good Twins, Evil Twins, Baby Swaps, Amnesia, Serial Killers, Clones, Aliens, Zombies, and that epic moment from Days of Our Lives in the 1990s and Marlena's Possession by the Devil.
I will use this body to destroy everyone in Salem.
Now, was this jumping the shark, as they say in the sitcom business?
It actually wasn't. I'm making this heavy argument about the social significance, the financial significance of daytime soaps. But they're also campy, and they have to have worlds of drama and some absurdity. That's also a part of the genre. I interviewed Deidre Hall, who played Marlena, and even though it was over the top, they talked about really doing it with sensitivity and care, and that it wasn't a mockery. It was showing the kind of havoc that could be wreaked on this fictional town of Salem.
Natalie, you're a very serious and respected news person. Do you still watch the soaps?
Yeah, I do. This passion project stems from the love that I still have. And, you know, this morning I was cooking dinner, getting ahead of the day, and I was able to have yesterday's episode of General Hospital on in the background.
Well, thank you for making time for us, Natalie Moore. And I hope you didn't get killed off by your evil twin brought back to life only to be possessed by the devil.
Thank you. I hope not, too.
That's Natalie Moore, host and writer of the latest season of the WBEZ podcast, Making. It's called Stories Without End, and it's all about soap operas. Natalie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
We've got more to come on Statewide. We'll return in just a moment. Still ahead this hour, we'll talk about the news, how to stay up to date, but not get overloaded. But first, a teacher is considered out of field when they're teaching a grade level or subject they're not licensed by the state to teach. In Illinois, 4% of all teachers are out of field, but as Peter Medlin reports, in one district it ballooned all the way up to 37%.
Over the winter, Kankakee School District Superintendent Teresa Lance met with every one of their nearly 80 uncertified instructors and gave them a choice.
One, they can decide to go back to school, or two, they can move into a substitute position for the 25-26 school year. But I was going to be recommending their termination for the upcoming school year if they opted not to go back to school to get their license.
Dozens agreed to get their license, and dozens of others were dismissed. It was Lance's first year as the superintendent. But how did Kankakee get to the point where their percentage of uncertified teachers was 9 times the state average? Beth Anderson says it began about a decade ago. She's a special education teacher of the district and the head of the teachers union. She says staff knew the status quo could not continue.
It felt like to us that we were just pushing students through. So giving, you know, the gentleman's F, the D minus. And we wanted to address that.
They wanted to be bold, to find the cutting edge of education to help them thrive.
So the state of Illinois offered the pilot program.
The pilot was for competency-based education, or CBE. Anderson says it's a model where students can prove their knowledge outside of traditional coursework, integrate real-world issues, and crucially, where schools can hire people with industry experience to teach.
So for example, we have health clinics in our high school, and the doctor that served that clinic taught biology in the high school.
CBE started slowly, just with high school freshmen, then rolled up to sophomores the next year, and so on. It was not meant to be implemented at lower levels, and in the first few years, they only hired a few non-certified instructors, so it was easier for experienced teachers to mentor them as they got settled into the classroom.
I think that gave administrators and community members the impression that this was a really good thing, that we could train people on the job, you know, and that it would work and it would be another opportunity to also address the teacher shortage.
90% of their students are considered low income, and low income districts like Kankakee tend to have the highest teacher vacancy rates. And partially because of those shortages, Lance says they started to get a little too loose with their CBE waiver.
Unfortunately, we use the teacher shortage as, in my opinion, a crutch to continue to hire non-licensed instructors.
Anderson agrees that when filling positions got tough, it became a path of least resistance. She says at the same time, several administrators left, which led to fewer professional development opportunities for the instructors, fewer mentorships, and less oversight to monitor how well competency-based education was even working. And the number of non-certified teachers expanded at the high school and even started dripping down to the lower level schools in roles where instructors were never supposed to be. Lance says they were in pretty much every content area, but they had the most in math, science, and special education.
So what I found out from the state is that we never should have had instructors in special education.
And as the number of instructors grew, Anderson says it started a downward spiral.
We started to have so many instructors and a system that just could not support their needs.
It caused conflicts between licensed and non-licensed teachers. Anderson says there was a mass exodus of teachers, which made it even tougher for the remaining teachers and instructors.
It's very difficult to watch someone flounder, to watch the students suffer because they don't have a teacher, you know, that can meet their needs. And so the whole culture just turned to be very difficult, stressful.
Students were struggling academically, and Lance says it was the first thing on her mind when she took the superintendent job last year.
I wasn't suggesting that not having licensed teachers was the only reason our students weren't performing well on state assessments, but I was absolutely saying that that was a contributing factor.
They spent the past year reversing course, and Lance says the goal is to have a fully licensed teacher in every Kankakee classroom by 2027. And to do that, they're on an aggressive recruiting campaign. They're staffing job fairs, hiring international teachers, and partnering with universities to bring in student teachers they hope will stay on after graduation. And obviously, they're encouraging their unlicensed teachers to get licensed. Lakita Foster is one of the instructors earning her teaching credential. She's been teaching sixth grade at Kankakee's Kennedy Middle School for the past 2 years. And while Foster may not have the right credential, she did come into the classroom with experience.
I was a preschool teacher for 6 years. My background was already in education.
She was recently accepted into the Golden Apple Accelerators program, which helps career changers get licensed to teach in specific targeted schools. And she'll be taking classes for the next year before she earns her credential.
When school starts back for us, that's when we actually go into student teaching. But since I'm already teaching my own classroom, they'll just set me up with a mentor.
Even though Foster already has a degree and experience in education, the jump from preschool to middle school is still really hard. It's a vastly different age group and skill set. She remembers her first few weeks scrambling to understand the curriculum.
I started to feel more comfortable because I took the time myself. I would bring it home with me and just look it over and review myself.
Now that Foster feels secure in what she's teaching, she can focus more on building meaningful relationships with her students. Union President Beth Anderson says Foster's story is familiar. She says plenty of their instructors had classroom experience and did great work.
We do have some licensed teachers who are teaching outside of their license. So they might have taught sixth grade for 20 years in the district, and now they're teaching eighth grade math.
Anderson says that all of the instructors had to have at least a substitute teaching license. They were also supposed to have a bachelor's degree in a related field, but again, over the past few years, that wasn't always carried out in the right way. But now, through Kankakee's aggressive recruiting, Superintendent Lance says they're making real progress.
Instead of 40% of folks out of field, we are now closing that gap. We won't have more than 10 to 15% of people out of field or out of licensure.
And aside from the instructor issue, they have to decide whether or not to keep the competency-based education model. Lance says they're in the middle of a curriculum audit to figure out what's working and what's not. But no matter what path they choose, they feel better knowing that every student will be taught by a teacher who can help them succeed. I'm Peter Medlin.
A fourth Commonwealth Edison co-conspirator convicted in a scheme to bribe the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan is headed to federal prison. Political consultant Jay Doherty was in federal court this week, his sentencing one of the final milestones in a criminal saga that toppled Madigan's political dynasty in Illinois and could send the ex-speaker to prison for a long time. Dave McKinney has been following the case for the last 5 years. He summed it up with Melba Laura.
Well, the headline is that Doherty got 1 year in prison, and that's slightly less than the 15 months that prosecutors were seeking. I mean, he was a true political insider. He was a ComEd lobbyist. And in that role, he funneled hundreds of thousands of utility dollars to several of Madigan's best political workers. And these were do-nothing ComEd jobs. That ghost subcontracting was all part of an effort to help ComEd pass legislation, and in Doherty's words on a government wire, to keep Mike Madigan happy. Doherty acknowledged today in court that what he did wasn't honorable, but Judge Manish Shah called Doherty and his company, quote, metaphoric cash in an envelope that amounted to bribes.
And Doherty's sentencing now means that all four of the former ComEd lobbyists and executives convicted in the Madigan bribery scheme have been sentenced. What are your main takeaways from their sentences?
Well, I mean, the common thread here is that these prison terms have gotten meted out to former ComEd CEO and Promajory Madigan associate Mike McLean and others have all generally been less than what prosecutors were seeking. All four now are felons, though, and you could argue that ComEd itself paid a bigger penalty. It was $200 million that they paid. That allowed the company to avoid any kind of criminal charges, but it was the largest penalty of its kind ever collected in Chicago's federal court. Promajory is appealing, and she and one of her co-dependents, John Hooker, they're having their legal tabs picked up by ComEd, which is kind of an interesting legal footnote here that we don't know if ComEd's going to try to claw that back or not once these things run their course.
So, Dave, like you mentioned, almost all the major players have now been sentenced, all with pretty light punishments. In your opinion, did this decade-long investigation really amount to less than what you expected? Did the public really get justice?
I mean, that's really kind of a subjective question. But you're right. I mean, these were not lifelong sentences. They've all been 2 years in prison or less. I mean, it's far under what Madigan himself got, for example. But as I said, I mean, these co-conspirators, they all have felonies on their records right now, and none of them are eager at all at this stage of life to be spending any time in prison. So, I mean, did the public get justice from this? Arguably, this is what justice probably looks like. One thing I'd note, though, we have some unfinished business here. I mean, Fidel Marquez was a key government mole that was awaiting sentencing. And yeah, he secretly recorded all four co-conspirators and Madigan and testified against all of them. So he pleaded guilty to a single count of conspiracy to commit bribery. And because of the help that he provided, prosecutors say that they're going to seek probation for him. And one other name that has been out there is a guy named Paul LaSchiazza. He's the former head of AT&T Illinois. And the feds alleged a similar conspiracy and bribery scheme that involved Madigan and the company. But there was a mistrial, so he's going to be retried next January.
So just a little bit of unfinished business. Before I let you go, what's the latest with Mike Madigan?
Well, I mean, he got the harshest criminal sentence of anybody tied to this scheme, 7.5 years. And he's scheduled to report to federal prison in October. And if it sticks, Madigan could be close to 90 years old when he's released. But his lawyers have launched an appeal, and they've asked that Madigan be allowed to remain free while this appeal's running its course. Madigan's got the same blue chip lawyers who persuaded the U.S. Supreme Court to narrow the federal bribery statute. That law was used to originally charge Madigan and the ComEd co-conspirators. And one other big unknown moving forward is whether Madigan has the means to reach President Trump to make a case for a pardon or no prison time.
That's WBEZ reporter Dave McKinney. He spoke with Melba Laura. Houses sell for more money in neighborhoods with big leafy canopies, so pests that can kill many trees quickly can pose real economic dangers. Some Midwest communities are hedging their bets. Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service has this story.
Imagine 1,700 graceful ash trees, 40 feet tall, lining the streets and public areas of your neighborhood and turning glorious colors each fall. It's what the Winterset area of Lee's Summit looked like, until it didn't. I'm touring it with developer David Gale.
Mm-hmm. So that's where an ash tree would have been.
The trees are gone because of emerald ash borers, beetles from Asia, and Gail regrets ever planting so many of them.
Yeah, that ended up being a major mistake because we did a monoculture of ash trees. So the dumbass developer thought, this is great, ash trees are native.
Are you referring to yourself in that sentence?
Yeah, I've got to be clear, the mistake was mine.
So now variety is the name of the game. In 2021, the Winterset Board finished replacing its ill-fated single-species treescape with lindens, blackgums, oaks, and a variety of other trees.
We need to learn this lesson.
Trees are an investment, and Kim Bomberger with the Kansas Forest Service helps communities diversify their portfolios. Over the decades, landscapers, city planners, and developers across the country went all in for elms or maples or Bradford pears.
I've done inventories where I've gone to roll into a neighborhood, and as far ahead as I could see, it was all pin oaks.
These monocultures are fragile. One pest and they're toast. Dutch elm disease devastated elms. Oak wilt thrives on pin oak.
When we plant a wide diversity of species, we're helping guard against catastrophic loss.
Loss to whatever new pest will arrive next, carried by global trade, and loss to extreme weather. Overland Park is one Kansas City suburb that hears the message loud and clear because nearly a third of its street trees are maples. That's like investing too much in one stock. So last year, the city put the kibosh on adding any more maples along streets and in new developments.
I believe they are correct. There's an insect called the Asian longhorn beetle that's in states in the eastern part of this country. Maple is going to be kind of like candy to this insect.
A major blow to a city canopy has many consequences. Kevin Boyle is an economist who heads the real estate program at Virginia Tech. When he and his wife bought a house in 2016, they set about planting trees.
You know, somebody just mentioned to us the other day, boys, that's really going to increase your property value. And my response was, yeah, you're right. I know from the numbers it will.
Mature canopies help home values, which boost tax bases for cities and schools. So, yeah, cities get nervous when they hear that different pests in different regions are killing off concentrations of pines, hemlocks, walnuts. Boyle has studied some of the hard-hit areas.
When trees are damaged and dying, it reduces the value of properties.
Plus, there's the price of removing and replacing so many trees. That cost Winterset and Lee's Summit nearly $500,000. And it'll take decades to get a mature canopy again. One like this that I saw in Manhattan, Kansas.
I'm walking down just a little residential street. The birds are really singing this morning. Baltimore Oriole chicks right here in the canopy.
To protect our decades-long investments, foresters have one more crucial tip to diversify our portfolios. Plant species from different genuses and families, so they aren't all close relatives with the same potential Achilles heel. Some experts recommend planting dozens of species, including non-native ones. Others say, bad idea. Too many non-native trees usually doesn't create the kind of scene I saw in Manhattan. Flycatchers, wrens, orioles, finches, all serenading a single city block. I'm Celia Yopis-Jepsen.
The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has released findings from two investigations into an accident at the Quad Cities nuclear plant in Cordova. Brady Johnson reports Constellation Energy has agreed on a set of actions to address misconduct and regulatory violations.
The inspections stem from an incident in 2023 when improperly closed coolant valves drained water from the Unit 1 reactor. The water sprayed two plant workers who were then not properly tested for radiation exposure. The NRC ultimately found the exposure did not exceed federal safety limits, but investigators found employees inaccurately documented the incident and deliberately failed to report it to federal regulators. One operator admitted to falsifying reports, fearing retaliation from management. Both workers have since been fired. The NRC's confirmatory order issued last month says Constellation has agreed to implement more safety and training measures, including a fleet-wide survey of its nuclear plants. The NRC has yet to issue a decision on regulatory enforcement actions against the power plant operator. I'm Brady Johnson reporting.
A reminder, the Illinois State Fair is now underway in Springfield. The fair runs until next Sunday, August 17th. Along with agricultural and livestock exhibits, there's a whole lot more: carnival rides, grandstand entertainment, and a showcase for many of the aspects of living here in Illinois. Find all the details at statefair.illinois.gov. You're listening to Statewide. More ahead right after this. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The news can make you feel overloaded, but you still want to stay up to date on what's happening. Sasha Ann Simons talk with some experts about possible solutions.
The news, let's be honest, it can be a lot. How many notifications on your phone do you get about the news in just one day? My anxiety is already spiking just hearing those dings. Now, we know it's important to be a well-informed citizen, and of course, we are more connected to the world's news than ever. But how do you stay checked in and avoid headline stress disorder that comes with all that doom scrolling? Joining us now with more is Alexa James, who's CEO of NAMI Chicago. And we've got Stuart Shankman, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern Medicine. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for being.
Thanks for joining us. So how did you, were you getting goosebumps hearing those dings as well, the notifications?
For sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For sure.
There's so much news all at once, I feel. Whether you're like super well connected to the news or not, it just comes at you from all directions. Is it something that you deal with personally, Stuart?
Absolutely, yeah. We all get those dings, and it's unprecedented in terms of human history, right? Like the access to news that we have, it used to be just the 6 o'clock news, and now it's
remember
it's
that
24/7.
6 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Alexa, you're nodding.
Totally. I mean, it's why listening to your show is always so lovely, because you do such a nice balance. But we're also, and we are drawn to the sad, the negative, the tragic. And then we start to mirror some of those feelings. So yeah, I personally do. I was just saying in the green room that I got the headline, for example, about the budget or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I need a break. I can't really dive into it anymore because it really heightens your anxiety.
So what do? You literally shut it down? Read the headline and you just close your phone and walk away?
Shut it down, because I think that, our anxiety can be utilized to say, what more information do we need to feel safe? I don't need any more information right now to feel safe. Mm-hmm. I know what I need to know for now, and I know what the next steps are.
Well, Stuart, Alexa said something pretty key. She said people are drawn to this, right? Why are we so drawn to seeking out information even when it stresses us out?
I think it's reducing the uncertainty. So right now, that the times that we're living in are incredibly uncertain, right? We don't know what the future is going to hold for our budget, for our city, for our families, our kids, and so when we seek information, that's an attempt to sort of reduce uncertainty. Which we in our lab, for example, has done a lot of work on people who are very sensitive to uncertainty. Mm. And that's a big mechanism of anxiety and anxiety related problems.
And what do you mean by being sensitive to uncertainty?
So, hypothetically, is it possible that a meteor is going to hit our building in the next 30 seconds? Sure. The probability of that is pretty low, because NASA probably would have identified it, and Bruce Willis would have been flying up there. but we sort of live without uncertainty, right? More realistically, we walk down the street, right? And we know there's risks of us, God forbid, getting hit by a car or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's some people who are so sensitive to that uncertainty that they need to gather information and try to reduce the possibility of these bad things happening. And I think, doom scrolling and reading about the news is an attempt to reduce that uncertainty.
Yeah. So
reduce that unknown.
Mm-hmm. Doom scrolling. If you look in the dictionary, it's defined as, spending excessive time online scrolling through news or other content that makes you feel sad, anxious, angry, etc. How do you define it, Alexa? What's doom scrolling to you? What does that look like?
I think about it similarly to other types of addictions that we have. And biologically, I think that's a lot of what's going on, because even though it makes us feel sad, we think that that means that there's not some type of return. There's not some type of reward system that's going off in our brain like a slot machine. And a lot of these algorithms and systems are actually built on that same precedent of giving us that hit, giving us more information, feeling like we're in the know, feeling like we have power. Mm. So, yes, I think it's dangerous, and I think it's super important to utilize our insight to say, okay, what am I going to do to shift this a little bit? Is this really serving me anymore?
So those friends of mine that I'm thinking of right now who are always unaware of what's happening in the news, for good and for bad, have no idea what's going on, super unplugged, carrying on with their lives. Have they won at life, Stuart?
I don't know.
Are they doing something better than me?
is ignorance bliss, right? That's, I guess that's the question. I think there's a point, though, right? There's a point of when you know, gathering information and being informed is important. But then at some point there's diminishing returns, right? And diminishing returns, and we were talking about this also in the green room, at what point is it going to change any action that you're going to do, right? So you might have some information. You're like, oh, I'm going to then, you know, tell my family, or I'm going to maybe call my congressman or something like that. But once you sort of do the action based on the information that you acquired, mm-hmm. maybe you should unplug.
How do you get out of the doom scrolling spiral?
You may need to set, well, for you, I don't know if you can. I mean, there's some jobs
where
you
can't. Oh, I literally cannot.
You know, right? I think that that's important to notice. And like, what types of supports do you have when this has to be your work? But mm-hmm. I think moving your phone away physically, which literally elevates people's, you know, heart rate, using an alarm clock so it's not the first thing that you're doing in the morning. I think that it's also replacing it. We say always replace a coping strategy, because this is a coping strategy, this doom scrolling, with reading or connecting. Being aware of things helps us connect. We are primed to connect with other people. Mm-hmm. This gives us the false understanding that we're actually connecting, and we're not. We're
just
connecting.
Yeah, I love for it to be like, there's something inside me that feels rewarded when I can have that conversation starter, or when someone brings up that thing, and if I know what they're talking about, yes. I jump in and I can add to it because I read that story and then I read the follow-up story and I know the latest. But yeah.
So there's ROI for you.
Yeah.
You feel like you can be a part of that room and that conversation in a way that feels helpful. It's when it becomes, when you start to sit in powerlessness. And the thing is, when you're constantly surrounding with sadness and with tragedy all the time, that's all you're consuming, that the symptomology of that is depression and anxiety, mm-hmm. and it can really lead to further isolation.
But unlike the friends I mentioned earlier, Stuart, there really is an importance in staying informed. Because mm-hmm. as I said, that was for the bad, right? You should know what's happening around you. Right. Whether it impacts your life or not, you should know what's happening across the globe, shouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think knowing about, you know, what's going on in the world and what affects you and your family is very important. But at some point, though, I think like Alexa is saying, we start to get in this negative spiral we call rumination. Right. Of sort of this repeated negative thinking that goes over and over and over again, and repeated worrying also about their future, this sort of repeated negative thinking. And then there's also this process called co-rumination, where we do that with other people. Mm-hmm. Where just this cycle that we do with our friends, whether it's in person or whether it's online in our social media communications of back and forth postings and negative and this co-rumination process that it's wheel spinning.
How does the body respond to the stress and this negative news, as you described?
Yeah, not well.
tell me what's happening inside.
Yeah, and so we have this cortisol response that's in our brain that increases when we have stress, particularly chronic stress. So there's one thing where, you know, you have like a sudden scare, right? You have a big spike in cortisol, but this sort of prolonged, sort of mild chronic stress does a lot of damage to our really all of our systems, our heart, our brain, our memory. Our stomachs are, you know, we know we get the sort of the
like that knot,
the knots in your stomach for sure. And so doing what you can to try to, be aware of that, of knowing, you know, if you're getting into this vicious cycle is I guess the first step, trying to identify, oh, here's what I'm doing. And I'm doing this maybe co-rumination process with my friends and people online. And then as best you can, trying to unplug, or as the kids say, go touch grass, you know, go outside and just sort of touch grass and that can be really
like
helpful.
We used to do back in the 90s, mm-hmm. as a child. I'd go outside and play until the streetlights went off. Mm-hmm. Like, my kids know nothing about that. Right. Tell me this from the mental health standpoint, Alexa. What is happening to our brains when we're just saturated with these headlines?
Well, we are in fight or flight. We are running from, we are operating in a place where our body feels like we have to survive, when that may not be the truth of what's going on. And so your decision, you know, building on Stuart's point, your decision-making is skewed. Your relationships with people can become fraught because you're distracted. It's hard to pay attention. It's hard to be decisive. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in a place of a lot of anger where there's not a lot of movement in that anger. So, yeah, it's dangerous to be all consumed with only negative things. And just as you just mentioned about the grass, we know that our environment can reduce rumination if green, if bright, if positive, if open, if welcoming. And now replace that with what the environment of a lot of people are, which is dark and tragic and violent. I mean, the amount of violence you can now have access to online is also. And so to Stuart's point, it is as though you are experiencing that same event. It is that it becomes that close to us.
And how does social media play a role in that?
Well, and social media influencers and other news influencers are also often elevating the negative story. That's the clickbait, right? So we're feeding into that cycle as well as consumers.
Mm-hmm. These symptoms that we're discussing, you know, how the body's feeling, what's happening in our minds, does that change if someone has a personal connection to the story? Because right now I feel like we're talking about, you know, when we witness things happening across the world or, you know, to our neighbor. What about when it's actually happening to our families, to us?
We're losing empathy. We have so much access to so many people's challenges that we don't actually feel them as deeply, or because if we did, we wouldn't be able to survive. I'm curious your perspective.
Yeah, I think when you have a personal connection to it, I think it just becomes more salient, right? So if it's like, and sometimes, you know, the bad stories that are happening in other cities and in other countries, like, oh, well, that's them. And we're, you know, especially in Chicago, for example, we feel often we're in a little bubble.
Oh, that's happening in Boston. We're in Chicago.
Right, right, right. And so I think Alexa's right that it's sometimes there's a lack of empathy. But when it does hit home, it's just like, oh, my gosh, like it almost makes it a little more real.
Yeah. Why is it like that? Why is that the default, you think?
I think because we are, at our core, community-based people.
For sure.
And we have pride, and we think if it's that close to us, it could happen to us too. So there's also a level of threat.
Mm-hmm. So give us then some tips and tricks for managing stress in general. Let's start there. Stuart?
Yeah, I think first sort of identifying when you are feeling stressed, sort of being aware in yourself. So noticing when your hands are clenched or your shoulders are tight and you have the knot in your stomach.
That's my number one symptom. It's the tight shoulders. Mm. I'll raise my shoulders. I just did it actually, but you couldn't hear it over the mic, thank goodness. I raised my shoulders and one of them popped.
Wow. Yeah.
Maybe I'm just also out of shape. But I digress.
Yeah, but identifying that and then being
it's
okay, and then relaxing, and when your shoulders go down, that's sort of the first step.
Right.
And when your body's relaxed, then your mind can be relaxed. And the opposite is also if your body's tense, your mind is tense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first step. And then, and as best you can, as we were saying before, trying to unplug, and trying to you know go outside and be with people socially to enjoy the beautiful summer, and do what you can to. And it's not like the news is going to go away.
Yeah. But don't unplug too much.
For sure.
Especially
this show.
Noon.
Well, and find gratitude. You know, how often are we seeing people when we are connecting? You know, anxiety is contagious. And so we're like, and this. Like, how do we kind of try to also change the tone in the conversation so that when we are connecting, it feels rejuvenating and not depleting?
Mm-hmm. Are there resources that you want to point folks to dealing with headline anxiety?
Well, people are always welcome to call the NAMI helpline. Always. If you just want to talk about the stress of the day, we have seen increases in calls to both 988 and to our helpline based on the news and people feeling marginalized. So we are here for you. We see you. It's free. It's confidential. I also think just like naming who in your life feels like a safe person to connect with around these issues. And then also remembering that you are not powerless. You know, to Stuart's point, like what would make you feel activated in these moments politically? Is it contacting your congressperson? Is it figuring out what advocacy efforts are possible? Remembering that, you know, you too are a healer in your community too, if you can show up maybe in a different way.
Yeah. So that call to action. That sense to, you know, get up and do something, that can help with our mental.
Absolutely, yeah, especially doing things for other people. You know, whether it's volunteer work or other charitable activities, makes us feel good inherently.
Yeah. Any other specific tips and tricks that you want to leave folks with, Stuart, just in the case of news fatigue?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think, like we were saying before, like being on the doom scrolling is an attempt to sort of try to get control of a situation. But there's other things you can do to try to get control. So doing things to take care of your body, to eat well, to sleep well, some of those basic activities.
Yeah. We'll leave it there for now. That's Alexa James, who's CEO of NAMI Chicago, and Stuart Shankman, who's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Northwestern Medicine. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Anna.
I'm going to try to take that advice.
We're out of time for Statewide this week. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.